KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of Springtime Carnivore, Thursday, August 31st at McMenamin's Crystal Ballroom in Portland. Springtime Carnivore is a one-woman project led by Greta Morgan that plays fusion of sunshine pop, psychedelica, and folk rock filtered through the lens of indie rock. Again, that's Springtime Carnivore, Thursday, August 31st at 8 p.m. at McMenamin's Crystal Ballroom, 1332 West Burnside Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Join KBOO every Friday at 5:30 p.m. for Counterspin, a show that provides a critical examination of major media stories and exposes what the mainstream media missed. Counterspin exposes and highlights censored stories, sexism, racism, and homophobia in the news, the power of corporate influence, gaffes and goofs by leading TV pundits, and more. That's every Friday at 5:30 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
The program that you're about to listen to is made possible by KBOO members and support from the Oregon Symphony, presenting a special concert, Angelique Kidjo, with the Oregon Symphony. More info and tickets for this event with Angelique Kidjo at the Arlene Snitzer Concert Hall on Tuesday, September 26th, available now at orsymphony.org. The program is also made possible by KBOO members and support from the Bloom Garden Supply. This Saturday, Bloom will be hosting a summer party that will feature live music and live broadcast of the KBOO Grateful Dead and Friends Tour. It's all happening from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at 102nd and Division. All are welcome. More info at bloomgardensupply.com.
Welcome to Native America Calling. From Studio 49 in Albuquerque, I'm Monica Brain. Two Muskogee men want their murder convictions overturned because they say they were tried in the wrong court. We'll hear about what this might mean for Muskogee Creek Reservation boundaries. Also, national monuments, statues, the Trump presidency in peril, and a threatened government shutdown. We'll talk about all of this with journalist Mark Trahan. It's our regular news roundup. We'll be right back.
This is National Native News. I'm Hannah Colton, in for Antonia Gonzalez. Reducing the boundaries of the newly created Bears Ears National Monument in Utah would amount to the federal government going back on its promise to protect the culturally important area. That's the reaction from tribal officials, environmental groups, and others following a recommendation Thursday by Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. The recommendations are still secret, besides a two-page summary, but several news organizations who spoke to people in the Trump administration say Zinke is proposing to shrink the boundaries of Bears Ears and at least two other national monuments established by Presidents Obama and Clinton. Julia Bernal with the Pueblo Action Alliance spoke at a press conference organized by U.S. Democratic Senator Martin Heinrich of New Mexico. Bernal says changing the boundaries now would go against the months of discussions and public hearings that led to the monument designation in December of last year.
It was promised to the indigenous people that our existence, our lands, are important to this nation. It is our government's responsibility to keep these promises and not take them back again. How many more broken promises are we going to have to endure?
Utah's congressional delegation and local officials were among those who opposed the monument, calling it an overreach of federal authority. Monument opponents say they want to reserve the right to utilize the land for grazing, mining, and other development. President Trump has referred to the Bears Ears designation as a land grab. A coalition of tribes, along with environmental groups, urged President Obama to establish national monument protections in order to protect cultural and sacred sites throughout some 2 million acres in southeastern Utah. In the public summary that referenced the report to President Trump, Secretary Zinke said the monument declarations resulted from what he called a well-orchestrated campaign by monument supporters. An Oklahoma tribe has hired a lobbyist in its efforts to open a casino across the border in Missouri. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch reports the Osage Nation this month hired a former speaker of the Missouri House to lobby on the tribe's behalf. The tribe in December contributed more than $50,000 to Missouri Governor Eric Greitens' inauguration, which Osage Nation Chief Jeffrey Standing Bear said was meant to establish a good relationship. A 1988 federal law allows tribes, in some cases, to establish casinos outside their reservations, if the land in question is within the tribe's historical territory. In this case, it would require Governor Greitens' approval. A dress code at a Texas school district is gaining nationwide attention after a 4-year-old Native American boy was sent home for having long hair. CW39.com reports Jabez Oates went to 2 days of pre-K before Barbers Hill Independent School District said he couldn't come back until his shoulder-length hair was cut. In a Change.org petition, his mother Jessica Oates says her family is Kokopa Indian and that her son loves his hair, which is considered a sign of strength. Oates provided documentation to the district to get Jabez excused from the dress code for cultural reasons, but the principal refused. A non-Native author who many say falsely claims Native American heritage is up for a national literary award. John Smeltzer's young adult novel, called Stealing Indians, is nominated for a 2017 Penn Literary Prize. The Seattle Alt-Weekly The Stranger reports novelist Sherman Alexie said, quote, Smeltzer has been held in great suspicion and contempt in the Native world for 25 years, end quote, and that Smeltzer has long relied on dubious claims. Those include lying about having a PhD from Oxford to get a university job. According to The Stranger, Smeltzer's adoptive father wrote to an Alaska newspaper in the 1990s to clarify that his Caucasian son was not Native. The Native village of Taslina in Alaska does count Smeltzer among its enrolled members. The Penn Center says it is aware of the concerns over Smeltzer's nomination and will investigate further. With National Native News, I'm Hannah Colton.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Support by BNSF Railway, proud partners of the American Indian Science and Education Society's National Conference, September 21st to 23rd, helping prepare the next generation of STEM leaders. More at bnsf.com/tribal relations. Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for more than 30 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain. Today is our monthly news roundup. Jurisdiction and regulation are at the heart of two of the stories we're looking at today. The Navajo Nation passed home site lease regulations, and some are wondering if these new regulations will cause headaches for folks living on the nation. We'll talk with a reporter from the Navajo Times about this. Also, a Muscogee Creek man who was sentenced to death in Oklahoma had his murder conviction overturned earlier this month. The case is complex. We'll talk with a legal scholar and Muscogee Creek member about what this particular ruling might mean for the Muscogee Creek Nation. But first, let's check in with our regular contributor, Mark Trahant, about politics and this crazy month of August. If you want to talk about Bears Ears, statues, or the Trump presidency, our phone lines are open. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2000. 2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us now from Grand Forks, North Dakota is Mark Trahant. He is the Charles R. Johnson Endowed Professor of Journalism at the University of North Dakota, and Mark is Shoshone Bannock. Welcome back, Mark.
Glad to be here. Thank you, Monica.
All right, so you agree it's been a little bit of a crazy month in August.
Been a crazy year, yes.
Where to start? I wanted to start with a piece that you wrote titled Clues from History, Why Donald J. Trump's Presidency is Over. And in it, you claim that Trump has been labeled politically toxic. Why do you feel that way?
Well, in the article, I do two things. One, I go through and look at how different states have treated leaders that have kind of fallen apart during their terms. And there's actually quite a history there, ranging from in Arizona when Evan Meekum was the governor. And Evan Meekum was a former used car dealer that ran for office regularly, finally got elected. And when he did, it was very much the same kind of chaos that we're seeing from Trump. And he actually kind of did a trifecta. He had an indictment, an impeachment, and then conviction and impeachment all going on at the same time. So we're not even near that level yet. Any president operates with moral authority, and it's partly what you can do on the stump, how you can rally folks, how you can get people to engage in the larger body politic. And you can just look to the Republicans. You don't even have to look at Democrats to see how little of that is left in the Trump administration.
Yeah, but Meekum fell out of good graces with his colleagues. And I mean, would you say that there's only just a handful of Republicans in Congress who are speaking out against Trump? So is that really an accurate parallel?
Well, yeah, some of them are really pretty striking. Bob Corker of Tennessee, chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, would have been the Secretary of State, was being considered at least for Secretary of State. So for someone like that to come out and say this administration's gone too far, I think is pretty extraordinary and pretty serious.
Well, let me throw that out there to you. What do you think? Is the Trump presidency over? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Mark, you say in your piece, Trump lost what was left of his ability to govern. An example of that was the topic that the New York City press conference was supposed to be about, infrastructure spending. This is an idea that ought to have broad support, not anymore. Few words about the plan were reported, and anything that a Trump label has now is politically toxic. That press conference was, right after Charlottesville. So is it really that's the situation, is that it made it toxic? Because I think, the reporters were just doing their job. They were just asking about Charlottesville, and not anyone had a question about infrastructure because that was not the thing that they were interested in and what was news.
Right. Well, definitely that was part of it. But even that, if he would have answered the question differently and been and in fairness, if he'd been acting like a professional politician to acknowledge the issue, move on, and then get to infrastructure, he could have done that. They call it a pivot in politics. But he just doesn't have that instinct. And instead, he digs it the hole deeper, and he makes it more pronounced. Infrastructure, really, going into the election, should have been one where they could have got Democrats interested from the beginning, because virtually every Democrat on the Hill would love to spend infrastructure dollars in their district. And he's just been unable to do even on that issue, which, again, it has a broad consensus.
I mean, do you think that's because he is, as you described, so toxic right now, or because there's more important things to be focusing on than infrastructure?
Well, certainly you can argue there are more important things, although there is a big infrastructure deficit in this country. Pretty much everyone acknowledges it, ranging from water pipe systems to roadways and mass transit. I think partly it's just the whole chaos in this administration And it makes it really tough to get business done. For example, right after the failure of the health care bill in the Senate, what you normally would do is to try to get that 50th vote. You'd start building your coalition and trying to inch people over. And instead, he attacks the Republicans. Even now, in that trip to Arizona, he attacked two of the Republicans, one of whom is up for re-election. And that's not how you win, folks.
Yeah, he's actively campaigning against Senator Jeff Flake. Are there any other examples of a president doing that within their own party?
Not really. I mean, the parallel that's most striking, and again, it goes back to Bob Corker and some of the other Republicans who have said this administration has just gone too far, is another Arizonan, John J. Rhodes, is the one who went to Richard Nixon and said, for the good of the country, you need to resign. And Rhodes was the minority leader in the House of Representatives, had tons of respect and clout, and it was that moment that really the Nixon presidency was over.
Well, I want to throw that out there to you. Do you think this presidency is over, or do you think that President Trump is going strong and will continue to? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. President Trump held a rally in Phoenix, Arizona recently, and one of the things that he talked about, in addition to criticizing the press as well as criticizing Senator Jeff Flake, he mentioned about building the border wall. And we have a clip here of him saying that he has no problem shutting the government down if folks are going to oppose funding for the border wall.
Build that wall. Now, the obstructionist Democrats would like us not to do it, but believe me, if we have to close down our government, we're building that wall. Let me be very clear to Democrats in Congress who oppose a border wall and stand in the way of border security. You are putting all of America's safety at risk. You're doing that. You're doing that. Again, the Border Patrol today, I said, how important is the wall to some of the folks? I met with a lot of them. And they looked at me, they said, it's vital. It's vital. It's so vital. And you know, we have walls. I don't know if you know, we're already starting to fix a lot of the walls we already have because we don't have to rebuild them. And we want walls that you can see through, in a sense. You want to see what's on the other side.
So President Trump talking about building border walls. Mark, there's a lot to unpack in what he shared there.
Yeah, the big one is the budget. And so the way to think about Congress right now is it's really three parties. There's a mainstream Republican Party, the Democrats, and then there's a third branch of the Republican Party, the House Freedom Caucus, that's really off on its own. And in order to pass any legislation in Congress, you really need two out of the three. It could be the Republicans and the Democrats, or it could be the Republicans and the Tea Party, or the House Freedom Caucus. It really could be any combination. And that's the problem now, is there's not the votes there for the wall, because both the mainstream Republicans and the Democrats are against it, so that's far more than a majority. So how do you get a budget in that mess? I think that's going to be a real challenge. House Speaker Paul Ryan said on Wednesday that he doesn't think there's going to be a budget before the end of this cycle. So that means that they're going to propose a continuing resolution to have the federal government operate on a temporary spending basis through the rest of this year. And even then, if the president vetoes that, it could cause pretty major problems with an early shutdown. But so the prospects of a shutdown will be high either in September or again at the end of the year in December.
But I don't understand why any kind of funding needs to, why there's a would be a fight over funding for the wall. President Trump campaigned on the promise that Mexico would pay for the wall.
Right. And Mexico has said that's not going to happen. It's going to have to be in appropriations, and the votes aren't there for an appropriation.
Go ahead.
I mentioned in a piece I wrote this week, one of the real challenges for Indian country is we get hit hard by shutdowns. There's a lot of programs that it hits payroll for tribes, particularly smaller ones that don't have the resources to dip into some other fund and keep payroll going. It can cause problems with schools, with clinics. It really is a major problem when the government shuts down.
And I'm just curious, though, with these continuing the bills that get passed to continue it, where they don't pass like a full budget, is there a lot of sort of wheeling and dealing to get those passed as well? Do people have to give up things, promise things, stuff like that?
No, to get a temporary one, they almost always do it fairly clean, where it's based on last year's numbers. They'll put some riders in there, but it probably will be a lot easier to accomplish because they'll be able to get mainstream Democrats and Republicans together on that. It'll be the House Freedom Caucus that will oppose it.
And how much is the House Freedom Caucus related to the Tea Party? We were talking about this in the office the other day, that the Tea Party used to be the hot topic, and now, I don't even know, do they still exist?
They do, and they're connected. The Freedom Caucus is older. They've been around for a lot longer, but they would be the hardest core conservatives that vote against any budget, basically, that don't want to spend federal dollars, that basically represent the most conservative wing. Where this is going to hit, probably even sooner than the budget, is on the debt limit. And again, you got to get two of the three parties to pass it. The federal government has already spent the money, so it's a question of just paying the bills. And the House Freedom Caucus has always taken the position that it should vote against the debt limit increase unless there's a new round of budget cuts associated with it. And this administration, like the Obama administration, is saying, no, that's not how you run a government. We've already spent the money, just give us the check. And so that has the potential to be a real mess. In fact, in my column, I call it a September mess. The failure to pass an extension of the debt limit won't just impact the U.S. economy, but it could impact the entire world economy, because so many money is basically an illusion. And as long as people believe in it, it works. And if there's anything that stops people from believing it, kind of the whole thing falls apart. And that's how dangerous that particular issue can be.
We are talking about the presidency today. We're talking about what Mark calls the September mess coming up, whether or not the budget will pass, whether or not the debt limit will pass, and how that will affect Native America. If you want to get in on this conversation, give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Also in a little bit, we're going to talk about Bears Ears and the National Monuments. If you want to share about that, how do you feel about that? Give us a call. Again, it's 1-800-996-2848. I want to switch gears right now and bring in another voice. Joining us now is Polly Dinette-Claw. She's a staff reporter for the Navajo Times, and Polly is Navajo. Hey there, Polly.
Hi, Monica. How are you?
I'm good. So you're newly started at the Navajo Times, is that right?
Yes, that's correct. I just joined the staff actually in August.
Fantastic. Well, congratulations on that. We brought you on here today to talk a little bit about how the Navajo Nation had recently passed some new home site lease regulations. First, tell us what are home site leases?
So home site leases are basically 1-acre plots of land that are given out. You can apply for them through the Navajo Nation. It used to be through the BIA, but in 2013 they gave those duties over to the Navajo Nation. And so they can be 1 to 2 acres depending on how much you can spend, basically. So that's what home site leases are.
So these regulations were passed, or new regulations were passed, I think it was in October. Tell us a little bit about them and what they're actually regulating.
So back in October, the Resources and Development Committee passed these new home site lease regulations, which hadn't been updated for, you know, decades. And some of the regulations include that you can no longer have a second home on your home site lease, and also in order to build additions to a home, in order to build corrals or any other outdoor buildings, you have to get a permit. And many Native American or many Navajos across the res are in violation of these, and so there was a lot of concern about how these regulations would be enforced now.
And, I mean, was there any discussion about, you know, folks getting grandfathered in? And so starting from this day forward, you have to get your permit, but the folks in the past can keep their sheds and things like that?
Yes. So that's one of the things that Mike Halona said. And he made it very clear that people who, like, were in violation of the you have to be, a home has to be 750 feet away from any major road. And so any homes that are within that 750 feet don't have to take down the building and move it. Those homes are going to be grandfathered in, and therefore it's homes starting now that have to be in regulation.
Are people worried that getting a permit is going to take a long time? I mean, is there a cost for the permit, things like that?
Yeah, so the permits are going to have fees attached to them. For example, if there is an addition that is built outside of your home site lease, you would have to either purchase that land or take down the addition. And so those are just some of the fees that get incurred through the process of getting these permits.
I read an article in the Navajo Times about a pretty contentious, well, it sounded like it was a contentious meeting where folks were really sounding off about these regulations. I think one person called them communism. There was another that said that, you know, this was not part of Navajo traditional beliefs to do something like this. Are folks pretty upset about this?
Yeah, people in the community are pretty upset about the new regulations. They felt that there wasn't enough time given to understand what these new regulations are. They also stated that they wanted more time to air their grievances about the new regulations. And there's also a lot of confusion around what these regulations are, when are they going to get enforced. There's also misconceptions about, like, the fact that there's this grandfathering in process that's going to happen, and that these aren't going to be, like, retroactive to homes that were built before the regulations.
Well, I was saying, so it's not a situation where Navajo Nation officials are going to be coming in with bulldozers and tearing down people's sheds and things like that. But that's what people are afraid of.
Yeah, that's what people are definitely afraid of. And they're also concerned that these five regulation officers, there's only going to be five regulation officers that are going to be hired to take over the whole Navajo Nation. And so they're not going to really be worried about, they're not going to be driving around the Navajo Nation looking for people who are in violation. Basically, what they're going to be focusing on for the first, for their first tasks is to really settle any land disputes that are happening, and they're going to be using these new regulations to handle those land disputes.
And Polly, what will you be looking ahead to be covering this story? Are there more meetings coming up, or will you be, checking with the Navajo Nation as this progresses?
So as this progresses, we're just going to be continuously following the meetings that are going to be happening. Mike Halona is really trying to get out there and make sure that people know about the process, about how this is all going to go through. But just making sure that the main concern is how these rules are going to be implemented, because the five regulation officers haven't been hired yet. And so they're still in the process of doing that. And so just really watching how these regulations are going to be enforced, if they're going to be enforced. And that's pretty much where our focus is going to be for the paper.
And what about you, Polly? Any other stories that you're taking an interest in?
So right now, the Navajo Nation is also looking into possibly allowing genetic testing. There is a 2002 moratorium ban on genetic testing on the Navajo Nation. And one of the stories that I'm currently working on is looking at how a policy like that would be implemented here for the Navajo people, considering we have very cultural and sacred teachings that go along with our hair and our DNA.
So when you say genetic testing, do you mean like DNA tests, like those National Geographic kits, or?
No. Okay. More like genetic testing when it comes to like various cancers.
Oh, research.
And so, yeah, so it's going to be research-based.
All
but
right.
Currently, after what happened with the Havasupai tribe, the Navajo Nation then decided in 2002 that they wouldn't allow genetic testing until a comprehensive policy was created.
Well,
since then.
Yeah, we'll definitely have to follow that, Polly. Sorry, we are going to go to a break. But you're listening to Native America Calling. It's our monthly news show. We'll be right back after this short break. Last year, more than 88,000 students were enrolled in medical school. Of those students, only 223 were Native. On the next Native America Calling, we'll talk with Natives in the medical field about why they hope more students will consider going into medicine. We hope you'll join us.
Hey, Anna, he and I, nay, oh, hi, oh, when I oh. Hey, Anna, he and I, nay, oh, hi, oh, when I oh. Hey, Anna, he and I, nay, oh, hi, oh, when I oh. Hi, oh, when they, nay, he and I, hey, nay, oh. Hi-yo, when-i-yo, hi-yo, when-ne-ne-hi-a-no, hi-yo, when-i-yo, hey-a-na-hi-a-na-i-ne-yo, hi-yo, when-i-yo, hey-a-na-hi-a-na-i-ne-yo, hi-yo, when-i-yo, hi-yo, when-ne-ne-hi-a-na-he-ne-yo.
Support by the Association on American Indian Affairs Indigenous International Repatriation Conference, Journey Home, Empowering Indigenous Communities in International Repatriation. September 25th and 26th at the Isleta Resort in Albuquerque, the focus will be on learning, sharing, and discussing cultural and human rights issues of returning ancestors and cultural items to their rightful places. Information and registration at indian-affairs.org. Support by nonprofit community lender Acción, providing small business loans to help strengthen local economies of New Mexico, Arizona, Colorado, Nevada, and Texas. Acción works with entrepreneurs growing or just getting started with an easy application process and personalized one-on-one support. 9% interest loans available through the end of August. More at us.accion.org or by calling 800-508-7624.
Welcome back. You are listening to Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain. Thanks so much for tuning in today. We're glad you can spend a little bit of your day with us. We'd love to hear some feedback. Send us an email to comments@nativeamericacalling.com. Also, you can post your comments directly on our website, nativeamericacalling.com. It's our monthly news roundup. Before the break, we talked with Mark Trahant of Trahant Reports about the presidency and the budget. We also talked with Polly Dineklaw from the Navajo Times about some home site lease regulations that are causing some concern on the Navajo Nation. Now, let's take a closer look at a case in Oklahoma. On August 8th, the murder conviction of Patrick Murphy, who is a citizen of the Muscogee Creek Nation, was overturned by the U.S. 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. Murphy was found guilty and sentenced to death in Oklahoma State Court, but he contends he should have been tried in federal court because he is a tribal member, and the murder happened within the 11-county area designated as Muscogee Creek Territory. Let's talk with someone who can help us unpack this. Joining us now from Lawrence, Kansas is Sarah Deer. She's a professor of women, gender, and sexuality studies at the University of Kansas, and she is a citizen of the Muscogee Creek Nation. Welcome back, Sarah. Oh, it looks like we lost her. Too bad. All right. Well, we also have Mark Trahant with us from Trahant Reports. He's the Charles R. Johnson Endowed Professor of Journalism at the University of North Dakota. And Mark, while we work on getting Sarah back, I just wanted to know if there was anything else that you've been thinking about in terms of the presidency, the Trump presidency. And, you know, are you thinking that we're going to see something like an impeachment or a resignation? Because you're saying the presidency is over, but how will that actually play out?
Well, and when I say it's over, I don't mean literally. I think he could actually. One of the examples I used in my piece is the governor of Maine, who actually carried out and did two full terms, but his governorship was not very effective, put it that way, and the legislature just assumed more and more power. And that's kind of one scenario, is that the Congress will just start taking more and more executive power, which a lot of people argue would be a good thing, that it's kind of tipped toward the president in recent years. An impeachment, I think, was probably the lowest of the options. The other one would be pressure to resign, particularly if there's any criminal, anything pops up with the criminal probe. The other possibility, again, far-fetched, but certainly within the realm of possible, is the 25th Amendment, where the cabinet could remove a president, and that's never been done before. But we're in an era where lots of things that have never been done before are happening.
Wow, that's pretty incredible. I would definitely want to take a look at that, and as it unfolds, see whether or not any of those possibilities will happen. It's our monthly news roundup. If you want to get in on the conversation, the number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Looks like we have Sarah Deer back. All right, Sarah, how you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you.
So tell us about the Patrick Murphy case, because this is a really interesting situation.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. It's certainly one of the most interesting stories to come out of Indian law in the last few years. This case has to do with a pretty horrific and gruesome murder that happened, as it turns out now, on the Creek Reservation, which many people thought didn't exist anymore. So it has, you know, significance not only for this particular defendant and, of course, his victim's family, but it also has tremendous implications for the Creek Nation itself.
And so what exactly is, it was a pretty brutal murder, and he went to Oklahoma State Court instead of federal court. Explain to us that situation for folks who maybe don't understand, like when an enrolled member on a reservation commits a murder, how it usually goes to federal court.
Right. So there's something called the Major Crimes Act, which was passed actually way back in the late 19th century. And that's that law allows or basically imposes a federal criminal jurisdiction over Indians who are committing crimes on Indian lands or Indian country.
But Oklahoma is a different situation, isn't that correct?
Well, it's been, yes, Oklahoma is sort of its own little world in Indian law, and one of the challenges has been whether or not tribes, particularly the five civilized tribes, or so-called civilized tribes, even have reservations anymore. And a lot of people, for the most of the 20th century, have been operating under the assumption that the reservation has been dissolved. So, in other words, there's no boundaries. There's trust land. There's trust land pockets all over what was the reservation, but a lot of people had been operating as though the reservation didn't exist, which gave the state then, the state of Oklahoma, power to deal with crime that happened on those lands.
Right, because when I look at a map, you know, one of those big maps that you get that has all the reservations and the little outlines, if you look at Oklahoma, only Osage is outlined as a reservation. And so how does that work currently now, this case aside, in terms of, like, for example, tribal police or services or things like that, if there is no, like, actual reservation boundaries?
Sure. Well, what's really interesting about those maps now is that the Tenth Circuit has essentially ruled those maps are wrong, right? So that those boundaries outside of Osage still exist, and those maps have been misprinted or just mistaken for a long time now. But what happens with what happened prior to this decision is that essentially the understanding would have been that the tribe would have jurisdiction only on these, like, individualized pockets of trust land. And so if it didn't happen on one of those particular plots, the crime, that is, then the state would assert criminal jurisdiction, even though it was now, you know, within the boundaries of the reservation. The state has been prosecuting these crimes for decades.
So then Patrick Murphy argued that the murder was committed on a within reservation boundaries, quote, reservation boundaries, and therefore should have been tried in federal court. And the U.S. Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals said yes and overturned his murder conviction. Does that mean that he is free?
Well, that's a great question. A lot of people are concerned about that. My understanding is that the mandate to release him has not been issued, which means he's still incarcerated. What needs to happen now is the federal government will need to file or indict him for this murder in federal court, and that's the proper venue for this case.
But how has the Muscogee Creek government responded to this ruling? Are they now, you know, drawing new maps, or, I mean, what does this really mean?
Well, that's a great question, too. And although I am Muscogee, I'm not part of the current administration, so I can't speak for the tribe at all. But you will notice that they did participate in this Tenth Circuit argument. The Assistant Attorney General and the Attorney General for the tribe, for the Muscogee Creek Nation, weighed in on this litigation and argued in favor of the reservation still existing. So because this has implications for Creek Nation, you know, beyond this particular case, it's going to give the tribe perhaps more authority in ICWA cases, for example. So there's just a lot of implications, and that's why I assume that the Creek Nation weighed in on this in favor of the reservation still existing.
Why do you think that Patrick Murphy wanted his case tried in federal court? Does it have something to do with he did receive a death penalty conviction?
Correct. Absolutely. I think this was a defense strategy. You know, when you've been convicted and sentenced to death, there's a lot of appeals that can happen in the aftermath of that. And because so much is on the line, so much is at stake, you know, attorneys for these defendants will try dozens of different arguments to help their client. And that's exactly what happened here, although a lot of the efforts really had to do with more of his mental capacity to be on death row. But along with many of those arguments, they added this question about jurisdiction. And that's because although the federal government conceivably has the death penalty, typically tribes have a say in whether or not the feds are going to seek the death penalty. And so this would give the client here, the defendant, potentially a way out of death row is to go to federal court.
Do you know if Muscogee Creek Nation has passed any kind of law or comment on supporting the death penalty?
I do not. I don't know that information, but it's probably available pretty quickly if we find the right folks to ask.
And is this ruling, this situation, is it kind of bittersweet? Because in one sense, you know, you have the non-diminishment of the reservation, you know, you're getting your reservation back, or it never went away in the first place. But at the same time, there's this very brutal murder that happened and a case about it.
Well, absolutely. It's a tragic set of circumstances that led to potentially, you know, a wonderful outcome. And that's really difficult. And as a victim advocate, you know, I have my thoughts and prayers to the family of the victim in this case, because this original crime happened well over a decade ago. And this family has been put through a lot, you know, in terms of that, the state proceeding, and now potentially this federal proceeding. So it is difficult, and I don't think anybody is really celebrating the fact that the conviction itself has been overturned. The celebration is a more a federal court recognizing that the reservation has never been disestablished, and that is a tremendous victory for tribes.
And I understand there's another case where a man is seeking overturning his murder conviction, a Muskogee man as well. Are we going to see now like a lot of cases that were tried in Oklahoma courts, Oklahoma state courts, and now folks are going to try and use this to get their cases overturned as well?
Well, I think that's a definite possibility. You know, again, when you're on death row or when you're sitting in state prison and trying to appeal your sentence, here's another argument that could be made. But I'm not particularly concerned about, you know, public safety and people being in more danger as a result of this opinion. You know, I think that tribes and states have worked well together. Tribes and the federal government have worked well together. And this kind of decision is going to require, you know, even more strengthening of efforts to solve crimes and to convict crimes. And I think it's going to eventually improve public safety for everyone, even though you're going to see what people are going to see as appeals of sentences by criminals who, you know, are trying to get out of prison. But in the long run, I think public safety is going to be dramatically improved.
Did you get a marker out and draw around the 11 counties on your Oklahoma map once the ruling happened?
I haven't done that yet. That's a great idea. And I'm curious to see if anybody has changed the Wikipedia entry to update that information. But I think you'll be seeing some interesting maps coming forth in the next few years.
I mean, is this going to be a situation where it doesn't exist if the state of Oklahoma doesn't recognize it? Like, they continue to fight and say, no, this goes in our court. You know, we don't recognize this.
I think that the battle will continue. I think that, you know, we don't know right now whether the state is planning to appeal. I don't think we know that yet. There's a couple different avenues they might have to appeal this decision, both at the 10th Circuit and then at the Supreme Court. But the reality is this decision, while it seems pretty controversial, is well consistent with a case that the Supreme Court just decided last year about the Omaha Reservation, which was a unanimous decision. So technically, the law is pretty settled at this point, and it'll be interesting to see what Oklahoma brings to the table next.
Yeah, that's Nebraska v. Parker, is that right? The
right.
Case. And tell us a little bit about that, how it connects to this case, because that had to do with liquor taxes, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the real question here is, how do we know if a reservation still exists, and then whether that's for a liquor tax or for a criminal jurisdiction? Basically, for any kind of crime, you know, where did it happen? Was it on a reservation or not? And so there's rules that the Supreme Court has set forth. And the most simple way to understand it is that if Congress is going to get rid of a reservation, they have to be explicit and very, very clear about that. And if there's no law on the books and there's no act of Congress which says we hereby diminish the reservation still exists. And so that rule became, you know, solidified and even more clear with Nebraska v. Parker, right, which is, you know, a unanimous decision from the Supreme Court. So even if Oklahoma were to appeal this decision to the Supreme Court, it's possible that they just would deny cert and say, we're not going to hear this. We decided a very similar case last year.
Absolutely. Interesting. Well, Sarah, it's definitely something we're going to keep following. And I want to thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me.
Sarah Deer is a professor of women, gender, and sexuality studies at the University of Kansas, and she's a citizen of the Muscogee Creek Nation. Also, we have on the line with us Mark Trahant. He is the Charles R. Johnson Endowed Professor of Journalism at the University of North Dakota. Mark, you know, this situation of jurisdiction and whether or not Congress is able to, or not that Congress is the only one who can diminish jurisdiction. Have you thought much about this as it relates to politics today?
Well, I mean, certainly there are elements that would like to do that again, but again, because the Congress is broken up into kind of a three-way split, there's really not going to be any changes on the landscape. It's going to be more of the courts that weigh these things.
Absolutely. And so one of the things boundaries-wise that has been in the news is the National Monuments reviews. There was supposed to be a decision about the National Monuments yesterday. A report was sent to the White House. The Washington Post reported that Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke submitted a report, and the secretary recommended reducing the size of Utah's Bear's Ears, the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monuments, as well as in Oregon's Cascade Siskiyou National Monument, according to multiple individuals briefed on the decision. But the report that was actually a summary of the report was sent to the public doesn't have those details in it. And so, again, we're kind of dealing with what it seems like a secret situation. What do you think about that, Mark?
Well, I think they're trying to keep it out of litigation. As soon as it's actually published and there's someone to reference, then they can challenge, somebody will challenge it based on the 1906 Antiquities Act, which gives the president the power to set aside land under the monument status, and there's no provision in the act for withdrawing it. So it's going to set up some pretty interesting legal battles, and I don't think they're quite ready to go there yet.
Yep.
One other thing I want to make, a quick point, is it's really remarkable that they're trying to undo monuments of this stature when they're trying to support monuments of very temporary statues and other things, particularly the Confederate statues. It's just such a twist of fate to have both of these going on at the same time.
Well, Mark, didn't you tell us last time when we were talking about IHS that you can hold two competing thoughts in your mind at the same time?
That's right, duality. This is a great example of that.
Well, you said that the president doesn't have the authority, but in the report that Zinke sent, it says right here, no president should use the authority under the act to restrict public access, prevent hunting and fishing, burden private land, or eliminate traditional land uses unless such action is needed to protect the object. It is Congress, not the president, that has the authority to make protective land designations outside the narrow scope of the act, and only Congress retains the authority to enact designations such as national parks, wilderness, and national conservation and recreation areas. So, I mean, isn't he kind of saying like they should have never used the Antiquities Act to make national monuments in the first place?
Right, but we're talking about a law that's 110 years old, and it's been used since Teddy Roosevelt especially. So the idea of them saying just now that, and it really, the Utah delegation pushed this as much as anybody. They did not want Bear's Ears. They did not want the Grand Escalante Staircase. And that has been driving a lot of the politics of it, is Utah trying to get back at that particular law. But it is a law, and it's going to be litigated, and like I said, it has more than a century. There's an interesting twist here for Indian country, and that is that one land a president did withdraw was Blue Lake at Taos. And Agriculture Department took over, and they didn't use the Antiquities Act. They just did it. And President Nixon, of course, in July of 1970, said it was wrong. It should never have happened, and returned it to the tribe. So there's kind of an interesting twist on that for Indian country.
Yeah, but the Blue Lake, it wasn't a national monument?
No, they never used the Antiquities Act. They just deeded the land to the Forest Service without any legal authority.
One of the things that was in the report as well was, it said, comments received were overwhelmingly in favor of maintaining existing monuments, and then added, a demonstrated and well-orchestrated national campaign organized by multiple organizations. The way I read that, that sounded a little bit like, well, yes, overwhelmingly the comments were in favor, but they weren't real comments.
Right, and it's fun. When you drive through the Southwest, it used to be a lot of those little towns would be where some of the real activism against the monuments would happen. Now you go through Blanding and Bluff, Utah, and there are signs welcoming people, and they recognize how much tourism it brings to the area and how it significantly altered the economic landscape. So I think part of it is that in Utah, again, this goes back to Utah politics, but one of the real hits the state has taken is the National Recreation Association used to have its national convention in Salt Lake City, and it said it won't meet there anymore as long as they're trying to withdraw these monuments. So it's got all kinds of different twists and turns.
Yeah, definitely. And there's definitely a contingent of Navajos who oppose Bears Ears. We've spoken with them on this show, as well as a contingent and the support of the Navajo Nation government for Bears Ears. So it's definitely something that we'll be paying attention to, as whether or not the secret report gets released and whether or not the boundaries are actually shrunk for Bears Ears. Before we end today, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about some friends of Indian country that passed away recently. Cecil Andrus passed away, and I wanted to know if you could share a little bit about him.
Sure. Cecil Andrus was Secretary of the Interior under Jimmy Carter, and he was a former Idaho governor. He was Idaho governor at the time, and in fact, I posted today a short about, I was just a 19-year-old editor of the Chauvin News, went for my first interview with him, and remarkable guy. He's kind of, if you think about politics the way you would like it to be, it would really be someone like Cecil Andrus. He was a straight shooter. He said what he meant. One of his great lines about treaties was that, imagine if you have a mortgage and about 15 years into the 30-year mortgage you decide to change the rules. Banks not going to like that. He said it's the same with tribes, that they've made these deals and it's up to the United States to live with them. And he was very convincing when he would talk to large audiences about that.
Was he viewed as, a good Secretary of the Interior?
I think he was an outstanding Secretary of Interior. Yeah, they some of the projects that went on, one, there was a huge water policy that he walked into that was not really good for tribes. It put a lot of emphasis on state water policy, and partly because of his openness to listen, Forrest Girard, Tom Fredericks, and Suzanne Harjo, working inside the government, were able to get that policy nuanced. He also funded a management improvement project where they talked about how the BIA over the years had grown too bureaucratic, and they wanted to look at just basic management functions, and they set out resources to make that work.
Well, we'll definitely think of him and his family. Another person that walked on just recently is Dick Gregory. He's a comedian and civil rights activist. Many called him a friend of Indian country. He was arrested for participating in the fish-ins in the Pacific Northwest. And Suzanne Schoenharjo wrote on her Facebook page, "Much sorrow that this great man has walked on. He and his wife put their lives at risk, and they went to the heart of the fish wars in the Pacific Northwest and went to jail fail nearly 50 years ago when anti-Indian, anti-treaty hate groups and the state of Washington were violating Native nations' treaty rights and beating up and jailing Native people for exercising their rights to fish. And we will remember Dick Gregory as well. Well, that's it for our news show today. Thanks so much to our guests, Mark Trahant, Polly Dineklaw, and Sarah Deer. We're back on Monday with a show about getting into the field of medicine. Our executive producer is Art Hughes. Our associate producer is Andy Murphy. Marino Spencer engineered our show today. Tara Gatewood is our host. Antonia Gonzalez is the anchor and producer of National Native News. I'm senior producer Monica Brain. Have a good weekend.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is approximately 5:58, and up next is Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934. And certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held. KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held. KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning.
Have you seen KBOO's Fuzzy Boo Van? It's a giant furry blue Muppet mobile that brings music and joy wherever it's found in Portland and across the region. We're having a contest this summer. If you spot the van, post a picture on Facebook.